This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Tonight on CNS News, police arrest Native American students for trespassing on their own campus. A diverse group of Cal students brings today's issues in race relations to the table. And can a local tattoo program help former gang members erase mistakes of the past?
Good evening, and welcome to CNS News. I'm Vianna Davila.
And I'm Annabelle Peavy. In this week's news, Berkeley's infamous tree sitters woke up to find intruders in their treetop homes. The UC police sent arborists into the oaks to cut their supply lines, tipping over makeshift toilets in the process. The sitters, who've been living in the trees for over 14 months, are in violation of a no trespassing order, but they show no signs of leaving their roost. And media from across the country came to Berkeley City Hall last week as pro- and anti-military protesters faced off over the city's attempt to give the boot to the local Marine recruiting station. More than 1,000 people waited on the lawn of City Hall for the council's decision. It finally came at 1 in the morning. The council backed down, voting 7-2 to withdraw its earlier letter asking the Marines to leave. But despite congressional threats to withhold millions of dollars in federal funds from the city, the council refused to apologize to the Marines.
The Bay Area News Group says it's facing very tough times. Their solution? Get as many employees as possible to take voluntary buyouts. The group owns 16 newspapers, including the San Jose Mercury News, the Oakland Tribune, and the Contra Costa Times. 1,100 employees of those papers have 2 weeks to decide. If that doesn't work, management says layoffs will follow. And hundreds of healthcare workers rallied in Oakland today to draw attention to contracts that will expire this year. The United Healthcare Workers West says that all nurses, no matter where they work, should get the same benefits and the same pay. And that includes contracts for employees at 100 nursing homes that expire beginning in March.
In Oakland last weekend, hundreds of people lined up hoping to trade guns for cash. The city's gun buyback program takes aim at residents to help prevent gun violence on the streets. Bernie Johnson has this report.
The recent surge in violent crime triggered the buyback. Oakland's murder rate stood at 21 by mid-February, nearly double the rate of last year.
We hope to bring a lot of attention to our interest in getting as many guns off the street. That's just that guns do kill people and that we do need more and more regulation of sales and possessions of firearms.
Senator Don Parada spearheaded the event and was the first to turn in his handgun at Allen Temple Baptist Church. People came from all over the Bay Area for different reasons.
Just don't have the use for them.
I've got newer ones.
In the church now, and I feel no need for weapons anymore.
A bunch of my friends, they're either in jail or dead or whatever, you know what I'm saying, maybe because of the guns.
The city promised $250 per gun, but 45 minutes and 100 guns later, security officials announced they'd run out of cash. That didn't sit well with everyone.
Black guys, we can't go down to the precinct. I owe you with my name, my address. I got felony, you know what I'm saying? Got felony. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Even without the on-the-spot cash, the city collected over 1,000 guns, three times more than expected.
You know, every gun here represents one that's going to be in the hands of someone to use it on an innocent person or use it in anger. Better they end up here and get melted down than end up in an evidence room at the police station.
It was last month's accidental shooting of 10-year-old Christopher Rodriguez that drove Senator Parada to launch the buyback. While the fifth grader was taking a piano lesson at this music school, a stray bullet from across the street shot through the wall and paralyzed him.
Since then, the community has rallied around his family and against violence. The day after the buyback, the music school sponsored a concert to support the Rodriguez family.
What happened to my son can happen to any child. And a lot of people come out here, it's symbolic, to demonstrate their anger with violence.
But even as the community came together, the violence continued in Oakland, where over the weekend, seven people were murdered. I'm Brittany Johnson for CNS News.
Gunshots in Oakland left 8 people dead and 5 more wounded in just one weekend this month. As the city mourns, CNS reporter Joe Bush visits the last stop for these victims and finds something very unexpected.
With 22 Oakland residents dead by mid-February, this one city has reached nearly half of the 59 U.S. military casualties in Iraq this year. So Oakland residents took to the streets and held a candlelight vigil to mourn the 8 shooting deaths that took place over a 5-day period earlier this month. Members of a community-based activist group called Silence the Violence held the vigil.
Give it up for Silence the Violence. Give a big shout out.
We know that, you know, doing a candlelight vigil isn't the answer. It's not going to get us out of this crisis. But we felt like it's times like these when people really start to lose hope.
But hopeless is just how many Oaklanders feel.
Because it seems that nothing is doing any good.
Lauren Taylor's twin sons were only 22 years old when they were gunned down on the streets of Oakland that very same weekend 8 years ago.
It's just hard every time I turn the TV on and hear that another mother lost her son or daughter. It brings back bad memories. You know?
We went to the one place all 8 victims would have to go. You put the coroner's office. And during our behind-the-scenes tour, we found out something unusual about these victims.
This time it was a high percentage of women. Usually it's men. We don't frequently get women, but for some reason this last weekend we had 4 women, which was highly unusual for us.
But he said 8 dead bodies in one weekend is just business as usual for the coroner's office.
If we get 20, that'd be unusual. 5, 6, 7, 8, yeah, it's a lot, but not something we haven't seen before.
Sergeant Bartholomew says the real tragedy is not in the high volume of numbers, but the city's inability to handle them.
Oakland police are in over their heads. They've got more than they know what to do with. I mean, they're just overwhelmed.
From civil servant to concerned citizen, one question is on everyone's mind. How high will the death toll be this year? In Oakland, Joe Bush, CNS News.
The city of San Francisco is set to issue municipal identity cards to residents. As Maria Jose Calderon reports, the program hopes to give dignity to those who are often on the margins of society.
Why not legalize all people in San Francisco? Why not document all people in San Francisco?
At a conference last weekend, San Franciscans learned how the ID program would work. The measure was introduced by Supervisor Tom Amiano.
I think there are many people, including non-citizens, elderly, transgender people, homeless people, who are made invisible by not being able to obtain identification for many, many reasons.
ID cards would give all these groups an identity without revealing their gender or even their address.
In this country, we are contributing with our work, with our taxes, to the richness of the country, and they have to give us something back, no?
The ID will give something back. Cardholders will be allowed to open bank accounts, get library cards, and eventually to pay for public transit. City officials and advocates for immigrant rights are promoting the measure.
We think that with this ID, they'll feel more empowered to come forward with police, increase public safety for all.
This acknowledges their humanity, it recognizes their humanity, and my goal is to make sure that the police department understands that and that it respects the new process that we have in place.
Sponsors hope the voluntary program would help undocumented immigrants to better integrate to society. But Leo Lacayo says there's a better way to help them.
By getting the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate to pass a comprehensive immigration law that has been supported by President Bush, been supported by Governor Schwarzenegger, been supported by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
I say, look around you, wake up, smell the coffee. The deal is that they're here, they're not going away, and they cannot be treated as second-class people. They deserve at least to have an identity.
And they'll have that chance in August when the ID program begins. For CNS News, this is Maria Jose Calderon.
50 medical marijuana clubs in Northern California are receiving threatening letters from the federal government. Michael Filtz takes us to one club where dozens of patients get their prescriptions filled every day.
At the end of the month, this place has to close. At the end of the month, we pray that there will be something going on.
Reverend Randy Webster runs the San Francisco Patients Co-op, which has been tucked away here on a busy stretch of Divisadero Street for almost 8 years, filling prescriptions for between 20 and 60 medical marijuana patients per day.
Us closing is to protect the landlady.
Last month, the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, sent a letter to the owner of the building saying she is breaking the law by allowing the co-op to dispense marijuana. While California allows the use of marijuana for medical purposes, federal law considers it a crime punishable by up to 20 years in prison. But patients here say the co-op is more than just a dispensary.
Every medical cannabis patient should have a center like this to come to.
This is like a community center for all the patients where they could come and medicate.
David Cohen is a patient advocate. He says the DEA's threats are unfair.
The DEA has consistently claimed no medical usability with cannabis. We're people like everybody else. We just use cannabis as a medicine.
But the federal government sees things differently. Their website claims that marijuana has no medical potential, that it's addictive and has long-term negative consequences. But Dr. Frank Lucido says otherwise. He's been recommending cannabis as medication since 1996.
Anything the DEA says about marijuana has to be suspect. And it's good for a number of things, including chronic pain, actually even has some anti-tumor properties in some animal studies. So it clearly has a lot of value that we, you know, are just now scratching the surface for.
But getting prescriptions filled may soon be another problem.
We really do need to have medicine available for patients. They need it. They can't get it in Walgreens, and most of them can't smoke it at home.
A DEA spokesperson says they aren't sure what the next step will be. But one thing is for sure. Come March 1st, this co-op will go up in smoke. For CNS News, this is Michael Filtz in San Francisco.
Removing tattoos can take several painful treatments and months to heal. For former gang members, the process can also mean changing their entire lifestyles. Viana recently visited a tattoo removal program that gives them a second chance.
Today, Jorge Bautista gets the chance to leave his past behind.
Hi. Hello.
We've already done that. He's starting the first of several treatments to remove his 17 tattoos. Reminders of his past growing up in West Berkeley, where he said he used to run with local gangs.
That's all really I grew up around, so I couldn't really stay away.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Thanks to Project New Start, Bautista is getting those tattoos removed for free.
On the surface, it's a tattoo removal program, but underneath that, it's a lifestyle change program.
Adriana Alvarado directs Project New Start. Anyone from age 13 to 25 can get their tattoos removed by a high-tech laser. The cost? At least 50 hours of community service and enrollment in educational or job training programs. For those over 25, the price is $50 per treatment. Cheap compared to other programs and a bargain considering the stigma it removes.
It's seen as a negative thing. Someone sees a certain tattoo, oh, that person must be a gang member. Oh, that person must be a bad person.
26-year-old Alex Evangelista got his tattoos while serving 7 years in prison for burglarizing the home of rival gang members.
Being in there, you know, I was running with the gang and stuff like that, so kind of just didn't really care and just put tattoos everywhere.
After his release from prison 4 years ago, Evangelista became a father. He decided to remove his tattoos for both his and his family's safety.
I don't want to be in a place where, I mean, a rival gang member see me, and I mean, he don't care if I had kids or whatever. I mean, all he's going to see is my tattoos.
And though removing a tattoo can sting, Evangelista and Bautista both say bearing the pain is worth the result, the chance to start over.
I feel like, I don't know, like a brand new person, you know?
This is Viana Davila for CNS News.
Tonight, we have a special segment on CNS News. For many young people, this is the first presidential contest in which race has become a prominent theme. Earlier this week, I sat down with a group of students from diverse backgrounds to talk about race, politics, and the media. We started by talking about Barack Obama.
I don't think it's possible for him to address race in a way that he wouldn't be judged by doing so.
I've heard a lot of people say that he's a post-racial candidate or that he transcends race. But I think in a lot of ways we're using a certain rhetoric that appeals to white liberal voters. And so I feel like Obama himself has been sort of moving around the issues of race.
You know, I disagree. I think he implicitly discusses this notion of race. I think when he talks about representing those who have had least access, those who don't have the opportunity, you know, he's implicitly speaking about people of color. He's not talking about the dominant culture.
I still have this sneaking suspicion that a lot of his support within the white community is people who are trying to feel good about themselves. It's like a very safe way for white people to say that they aren't racist by voting for a black candidate. But I feel like he's not really addressing the issue of race in any meaningful way.
Then I would have to say that a national campaign for the President of the United States is not the place to do that. People are not going to be receptive to someone standing in front of millions and saying, you know, let's break down the race barriers. That's not appealing to people.
How successful do you think the media has been in taking the racial discussion beyond just black and white?
I think in terms of being successful in recognizing the gray areas between, you know, Asian Americans, Latinos, it's still not recognizing it. And one of the unfortunate things about the election is that it's reinforcing this dichotomy, which I think, you know, is sad. We're not talking about McCain as being the oldest potential president, but we are talking about, do we want, you know, a female president or an African-American president?
What particularly bugs me about, like, just race issues in the media is that when it comes to portraying Arabs after 9/11, they're all terrorists. When it's Asian males after VTech, all Asian males are aggressive, you know? But then when, like, Timothy McVeigh, like, does the Oklahoma bombing, like, white people don't have to live up to their name, you know?
I also think that it's important that we teach our children what's so often overlooked in the media, and that's the difference between race and ethnicity. It's a very different thing to be black and to be African-American and to be Nigerian-American, which myself I identify with. So I think that if the media can go deeper into something beyond race, because people's backgrounds are really important.
Well, really diverse table here. I mean, did you guys grow up sort of being aware of media, how it affected you? And if so, how did that factor into, you think, your perception of the world or yourself?
For me personally, I kind of think that I grew up to be white. under American Eurocentric curriculum at school, and, you know, I was watching the media, I was watching the news, and growing up, it didn't take me until I actually came to Berkeley to make me realize that, you know, I'm Filipino, I should be proud of that.
And you feel like the media played a role?
I definitely feel like it has.
Whose responsibility do you think it is to make sure that there are more accurate perceptions of minorities, ethnic groups, things like that? How do you do that?
I think the distinction is between responsibility and actually the power to do it. There's a difference between being active and being articulate about certain problems and actually having the power, the opportunity, the ability to make certain changes. Maybe there aren't enough people of color who are writing in to express their opinion. When they are writing in, maybe they're not being recognized.
I'm working with a group that's working at Berkeley Technical School, and what we're trying to do is trying to get them to write or put their writings into a magazine that we can try to showcase for the Berkeley community. And just little things like that is what makes me hopeful that, you know, change might be able to happen.
Oh, it sounds like people had a lot of interesting things to say. What was one of the things that stood out to you most?
Comments about the Daily Cal really stood out to me, and the fact that some students felt it maybe mischaracterized certain groups on campus. And in general, I just got the impression that race really is a big topic for students here.
Do you think that that's something that extends to other campuses too, or just Berkeley?
Most definitely. I think Berkeley's a really good representation of what's happening across the country, especially because of this presidential election.
Thanks. And on another California campus, the state's first and only Native American university is clinging to life. Manal Ahmed has the story from DQ University in Davis.
DQ opened its doors in 1971, at the peak of the American Indian Civil Rights Movement. Of 34 tribally controlled colleges in the country, DQ is the only one not on a reservation.
The idea was to try and develop an institution where they could come in and it would be the surroundings would reflect who we are as Native people.
The school was funded primarily by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and was once a vibrant hub of Native American culture. In its heyday, more than 500 students a year strolled its grounds.
There was representatives from 42 countries here through the United Nations. There was tribunals were held here, powwows every spring and the fall and in the summer.
But today, DQ is a shell of its former self. Over the years, enrollment fell dramatically and critical federal funding was taken away. Then, in 2005, amid reports of financial mismanagement, DQ lost its accreditation.
You know, we had an administration, and that administration, basically behind our backs without us knowing, took the rest of the funding that we had and just sort of and squandered it. And you know, I don't like to beat around the bush on that. They squandered it.
Currently, the school has no administration. But CNS was able to contact former President Victor Gabriel on the phone. He denied any personal wrongdoing, but said, quote, the entire staff was corrupt, unquote, and $400,000 had been misappropriated. Gabriel gave no further detail, but according to published reports, the Department of Education confirmed a misuse of funds.
And they were robbing students of their financial aid, and they were filling scholarships out for us and not telling us about it.
Still, no criminal charges were ever filed, and the university remains more than $250,000 in debt. In spite of all that, a handful of students refused to leave the campus, going so far as running their own informal classes.
One of the agreements to the deed to the land states that we have to be having classes here. If we don't, then that's a reason that the government can come in and take away the land. So for the school to be stagnant is unacceptable.
Students say they can't even rely on their board of trustees for help.
For years now, they've been very stagnant. And they've been very secretive of their agenda and their plans.
Last week, when CNS tried to film a public board meeting, our camera was thrown out.
Cameras out or I'll take them.
I just said, take your cameras out.
They're the board of trustees, and they're supposed to be working for the students. They're supposed to be working for the young people. But instead, they're trying to find ways to get rid of us.
In fact, the same board member who banned our camera from the meeting was reportedly among those behind a call to the sheriff's department 4 days later, asking the students be evicted. Sheriff's deputies arrested three students and charged them with trespassing.
I'm an Indian person, and I signed on here to help Indian people and to help this place, but it's very difficult to fight against Indian people.
Former student, professor, and chancellor Dennis Banks believes that for DQ, there's only one solution.
How do you fix something that's been patched over and patched over again and patched over? I would love to come back and say, okay, let's do it again.
For now, students are back in their dorms, tending to the land, and looking to the day that DQ will open its doors once more. This is Manal Ahmed for CNS News.
And last week, DQ hosted a rally commemorating the 30th anniversary of a landmark in Native American history, the longest walk to Washington, D.C. Now Jacob Seamus reports from Alcatraz, where the second longest walk began.
Early on the morning of February 11th, 200 Native Americans and their allies set sail to Alcatraz for a sunrise ceremony, the official beginning of the longest walk too, a march from coast to coast. Planning for the longest walk began over 2 years ago, and as organizers hammered out the final details, the magnitude of the walk began to set in.
Those are going to be committed to go on that walk, they're going to have to be some discipline. They're going to have to be some discipline because it is going to be dangerous.
The longest walk will cover 4,000 miles with stops to hear the concerns of Native communities along the way.
We're going to be meeting with elders, children, grassroots organizations that are talking about sacred site issues, environmental issues. We're going to be listening to all of these and we're going to include those in our position paper.
It's been 30 years since the last longest walk, which was a response to legislation that would have nullified long-standing land treaties.
The awareness that the longest walk brought in 1978 was catapulted a lot of the Native issues. Today we're still dealing with sacred sites and religious issues, and many of our people are still being prevented from practicing their religion or practicing their, you know, their ways.
Much has changed since 1978, but those who remember the first walk say life on the reservation has not improved enough.
And today what's happening now is the fractionization of the land. So the reservations are shrinking even more so. And we're losing a lot more of our rights.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome.
Tashina Banks Moore is the daughter of American Indian Movement co-founder Dennis Banks. She says the first walk was instrumental in retaining Native American rights.
But has things moved in a positive and a forward direction? We have a long way to go.
For some, the longest walk, too, is an opportunity to pass the torch of Native American activism to a younger generation.
Our people will always be walking. To me, walking is what you could say in our history. Walking and running was a way of bringing messages. Today, we're just continuing, you know, to carry those messages from community to community, from nation to nation.
The walkers hope to arrive in Washington, D.C. on July 11th, where they will deliver their manifesto to the Capitol. Reporting from San Francisco, this is Jacob Simas for CNS News.
Before we say goodnight, some fellow students from the Graduate School of Journalism are going to the Student Emmys. The nominees are Clayton Warfolk, who produced a program on China and the environment, and Adi Sambamurthy with his program Crossroads. That show includes a piece by Zach Stauffer about the rising popularity of baseball in Ghana.
I'm just curious why, of all the stories that you could have picked about Ghana, that you chose baseball.
Like a lot of people, when I told them about the story later, had a reaction, something along the lines of Africans don't play baseball. And figured, you know, it'd be neat to look into what the game was like there, what were the fields like, what were the practices like, what was the enthusiasm for the game. But really found that that the guys just love the game like kids do here, and they want to play and have a good time.
In addition, Dwayne Moles produced a story on the coal industry in China.
My story started out as a more basic environmental story about subsidence, which is when you mine underneath of things, they collapse. But then it really became about the sort of the pressure that the Chinese people feel to keep producing energy. If someone tries to fight back because they're losing their home, the demand for energy and the demand that China's great boom puts on society means that, you know, individuals just get brushed away.
Congratulations to all the J School students nominated for Emmys this year. The ceremony is March 15th in Los Angeles, and the first place trophy comes along with a $2,000 cash prize.
What are you going to do with your prize money? You're going to win something. What are you going to do with it?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, they only pay for hotels for one producer to go down. That would be the show producer. So probably anything we win will just cover our hotel and, you know, and a little booze to celebrate.
The life of a student.
Yeah, basically.
Thanks a lot, Dwayne.
No problem.
That's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. I'm Annabelle Peavy.
And I'm Viana Davila. See you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.